Hi, my name is Kasia Krzyżanowska. I am a co-managing editor of the Review of Democracy. It is my pleasure today to host Hanna Eklund, who is a tenure-track assistant professor at the University of Copenhagen. And just recently, she has published a very interesting paper, which was called People, Inhabitants and Workers, Colonialism in the Treaty of Rome, in the European Journal of International Law. And we will talk about the themes from this article today. So welcome, Hanna.
Thank you. Thank you. It's really nice to be here.
Let me start with sketching some context for our conversation today. So the overall narrative of the European integration usually starts with the prospects of establishing eternal peace in Europe after 1945. But there is a fairly recent line of research that uncovers another important layer of these beginnings. So it depicts how colonialism and its ideology were reflected in the European Economic Community, institutions and procedures. In your recent contribution, you study how the EEC legal categories were shaped by colonial politics. So would you like to shed some light on the extant research on this topic, whether ideological or directly political beginnings of the European Economic Community, and what new perspective your paper aims to develop?
Yeah, thank you. To start with the existent research and the field, I would say, I think, first of all, it's important to remember that similar sort of inquiries have happened in international law for several decades. So within the context of TWAIL or Third World Approaches to International Law, generations really of scholars have been looking at how concepts, institutions of international law have been shaped by colonialism. So that is there, and that is, I think, is something that is in dialogue with what is happening in European integration studies. So within European integration history studies, it is important to mention historians such as Kieran Klaus Patel, Giuliano Gheravini, who have been looking at how colonialism shaped early European integration. Also, the book on the concept of Eurafrica by Stefan Jonsson and Pio Hansen. Veronique Demier, political scientist, who have written about how actors who were trained in colonial administration went into EU institutions and shaped their procedures. That is an important piece of scholarship too. And I would also like to mention, because I think it is interesting, there is a group of North America-based French historians who've written about, say, the intersection between the end of French Empire and early European integration. That is Megan Brown, who written about Algeria, Frederick Cooper, Emmanuel Sada, and Emily Marker, written about citizenship and cultural policies and so on. So there is a multidisciplinary field who are looking into this, and I'm not mentioning all of it. What I have done that has not been done before, I would say, is to look at how the treaty, the legal drafting of the Treaty of Rome of 1957 was shaped by colonial legal politics of the time. And what that does, as you started sort of your question by saying, is to calibrate, I would say, not replace, but to calibrate the classic narrative of why and how and for which reasons European integration started. And so what I aim to show is that in addition to the classic inter-European peace idea, there was also ways in which the Treaty of Rome functioned to handle colonialism, to handle the people who were colonized and who were implicated in European integration in this way.
Thank you very much for this overview. Precisely, as you mentioned, how the European treaty drafters envisioned this colonialism or colonial politics, it brings me to my another question about the coded colonial language, as you name it, in your paper. So what was that? What kind of coded colonial language did the drafters use? And how did their language, full of euphemisms, deprive people assigned to certain categories of their rights? and what might have been other functions of this coded language, and how did those affect the constructions of certain EU principles?
Yeah, I think so. The main one to me is the simple one, which is that the colonies were called overseas countries and territories, and that has then become OCT, an OCT law. And that term was not new. It had been used in French colonial administration for at least a decade. The idea that, and many people have written about how colonialism changed its language to, you know, development, trusteeship, funds, and new institutions in this period in time. So the EU or the EEC sits within that broad trend of changing or updating your language in this period in time. But what did it do to the development of EU law? The fact that you had that euphemistic language. I would say that, at least my theory would be that it allowed this OCT law to live on, you know, through various treaty iterations and until today. So it's the exact same language that was there in 57 is there in the Treaty of Rome. So what does that mean? It means, for instance, that there is no way of exiting once you're, if you're associated by virtue of being a colony, you cannot exit from that status. So there was no contemplation of independence of these territories. Also, the word inhabitants is used to describe the people who live in colonized countries and territories, not the word peoples. And peoples, of course, at this point in time had legal stakes. It was the word that indicated the right to self-determination. And as I show in my article, that was deliberately not used. And instead you had this term inhabitants, and that is still used. So my view would be that in some way, the longevity of the OCT and the sort of unchallenged nature, or that it was not challenged, I think, at least in part, is explainable by the fact that we have kind of bought into this, what I would call coded language.
Sure. Yes, yeah, so as you mentioned, the independence and self-determination, it brings me to my third question. So it seems that the European drafters did not take the independence of their former colonies seriously. So how did the decolonization process in Africa influence the drafting process of the first European treaty? How did the EEC leaders react to the independence movements as they appeared?
Yeah, I think in one way, the easy way of saying it's not at all, sort of, or at least within the treaty negotiations. So that was really one of the things that fascinated me the most when I started to read the archival material from the Intergovernmental Conference of 1956 to 57, which is the official name of the Treaty of Rome negotiations, is that there is no reference at all to any of the clearly ongoing processes of decolonization, to the wars of independence. And so I use different sources to make the same point. And my point is to say that the Treaty of Rome regulated colonialism in the midst of the colonization. One way of how do we view that? What was that? You know, why, how could that happen? And I think one way of framing it, it's a kind of a mindset. You know, it's a mindset because it's, of course, not a question of not knowing or not being involved in these debates. Because if you take an example, an example of an actor, Paul-Henri Spaak, who's often cited as the father of the common market, he was writing at the time in the journal Foreign Affairs in response to the Suez crisis. He was writing something along the lines of, where are the political leaders who will defend Europe's precious inheritance? So defend the colonies. So I think that people involved, actors involved in the drafting, were of course also involved in arguing, in this case, against the colonization at the same time. But It is as if it is not at all happening if you read the negotiations. I also look at this report from a UN committee from the early 60s. And that is a committee that is put together to look at how European integration affected African economies. And this committee, it's a, they're almost bewildered. They're like, this Treaty of Rome, it's very detail oriented and it's very, very careful regulation, but it has not at all contemplated the independence of any of the colonies. And at least they must have known that Cameroon would be independent within a few years. It's a bewildered report. How could this have happened? How could something that was so meticulously carefully regulated just have overlooked this possibility? So, yeah.
I have a follow-up question on that. I mean, as you mentioned, it was the matter mostly of the mindset of the drafters. I wonder when would you pinpoint the moment when this change in the mindset occurred, if ever occurred? Because I remember when I was at the Museum for Central Africa in Belgium, in Brussels, and then I discovered they discussed the decolonization process in a very particular way. So they mentioned that the speech by Lumumba, in which he called for independence, was controversial. And it's 2024, and we still use this kind of language, particular language. So, would you say that this change has ever occurred? Or when?
Yeah, I mean, it's a, so I think two things. I think maybe that we want to view the end of colonialism as something very clear cut, you know. And I think that on the one hand has clearly not happened, and many people show in different ways how it continues and so on. And at the same time, generations of Europeans have been able to live with this, and you can see different manifestations of how you have lived with and accommodated this history without really, you know, exploring what it has meant for us in Europe, even, you know, or for our laws or for the way our, you know, knowledge is presented, or universities, or I was going to say museums are. The artifacts and museums are presented. So I would say I'm sure that we think about it differently than the people of the 50s, but there is no clear, perhaps, moment when we have seen a kind of a sharp reckoning, even though I would like to think, of course, that as generations, you know, we have matured into a position where we are better at recognizing this.
Sure. Let us talk maybe about how the peoples of Europe were envisioned. So, in the context of your analysis, the following words uttered by Jean Monnet sound particularly ironic, and I quote here: "Equality is essential in the relationship between peoples. Peace cannot be sustainable if it is based on discrimination." End of quote. Why did treaty drafters focus so much on peoples rather than on states or citizens?
Yeah, so the theme, let's say, in my analysis of these three concepts is that they all rely on a distinction which was central to colonial law, namely the distinction between citizens who were ethnically European and citizens or people with different forms of legal statuses who were from colonized populations and who were not ethnically European. And then I show how that distinction reflects in these three categories of peoples, inhabitants, and workers. And when it comes to peoples, I kind of make the case that if you would have said at this point in time in 57, if you would have said, we want to create an ever closer union amongst citizens of Europe, you would have indicated a much broader group of people than those living in continental Europe and being ethnically European. If you would have said those the member states, or if you would have even intended, all of those governed by the member states are supposed to be in this European integration project. You would have talked about a much, much broader group of people. So instead, what you do in the drafting is that you say it's the peoples of Europe. And by doing that, you're indicating a sort of an ethnical belonging to the nation, to the European nation. And you say these are the beneficiaries of European integration, not all those governed by the member state at this moment in time.
You also analyzed the concept of the worker in the Treaty of Rome and how the six founding members advocated for an exclusionary understanding of the concept to protect their own interests of their own full citizens. In general, how would you characterize how they thought about the individual, given their particular understanding of the categories of peoples, inhabitants, and workers? And more generally, how should these legacies of racialization change our narrative concerning the origins of the EU?
I think it's a very good question, that of the model citizen or individual. I think that at the very least, you would have to say that the drafters were comfortable with these distinctions that came from colonial law, that were based on ethnicity. And that distinction was clearly there, and they were looking for different techniques for how to incorporate it. And they use, for instance, the term national workers. Can we use national workers to distinguish between workers who are citizens, ethnically European, workers who are citizens, non-ethnically European? So clearly they were comfortable with that distinction. Now, it's also important to say that they were within the EU member states or the EEC member states, there were different views on how the extent to you know, how they wanted to incorporate workers from the colonies. So France was, for instance, open to have certain parts of the Algerian workforce incorporated. Italy did not want to do that. So, but in the compromise that was forged, clearly, it relied on this distinction, and that was written into the treaty. And so the question is, what does that mean? And for me, it means that when we think about, I mean, for me, it's important to make the turn to today. So when we look at today, which is a different political context, we see I would say, a renewed interest in distinguishing between EU citizens based on ethnicity. And that is not to say there is a causality between 57 and now. But it is important to point out that that legal construction was there and it was used in 57, that and that there is a renewed interest or an increased interest in that legal construction again to treat citizens, and we're not even talking about non-citizens, we're just talking about citizens differently depending on if they're born in the EU or if they're not born in the EU. And I think that by recognizing that there is such a pattern, or there is such a repetition within European integration, I would hope that we become more resolute in trying to overcome that and in trying to call it out and in trying to not accept it as lawyers and as, I don't know, academics, people analyzing legal developments, people discussing the political context of today. So for me, it is the importance of, as you were saying, this is a question of the original narrative and how it has changed, or how we can change it, or how we can nuance it. That nuance, that calibration, I would hope makes it easier for us to analyze what is happening right now, or to do that with a greater sense of clarity.
Could you elaborate a bit more on how these categories, colonial categories, influence today our today's understanding of the citizen, of the concept of the citizen in the EU?
I think that I don't I would so I don't think it's a question of saying that it's a a causal, a causal link, because I think that is not at all. I'm interested in thinking about it more as a kind of a repetition of the exact same figure, and I think that there is, there's both, I would say, in case law and in legislative efforts. If you take the Scandinavian countries where I'm sitting right now, you're a Swedish citizen, but you're not Swedish. You're not an ethnical Swede, or you're a Danish citizen, but you're not actually an ethnical Dane. So that interest in making that distinction, to me, is the same legal construction, the same legal project, if you will, as what happened in the colonial context, in the colonial era, where you were saying, oh, you both belong to France, but one of you is the real French, and the other is a French subject, or the other is a French something else. And I think just acknowledging that we have this repetition, not a claim of one causing the other necessarily, but just that repetition, to me, is a way of sharpening this. Sharpening the stakes really in the analysis of what's going on in our contemporary political context.
Sure, now it's much, much more clear to me. My last question would regard also contemporary EU. So, in the context of a historical reading of the Treaty of Rome and colonial origins of some of the key EU terms, like the principle of non-discrimination or the concept of the peoples of Europe, how do you suggest we should relate to these ideas today and how we should think about decolonizing our current treaties and who should take the responsibility for doing that?
I think in terms of so just where you could start to look, like, concretely, I would say that a very important question I think that should be asked in the next treaty reform is, should the EU associate colonies? Is that sh should that be done? Is that something that should be done? And should it be done on the terms that it's currently done, which is mainly that you could do that without even asking the people who live there if they want to be associated or not, and there's no way of exiting if you become independent, or there is now de facto you that's what will happen, but there is no formalized procedure for doing it. I think that that should be a question, and then also then, as I said earlier, in the language of describing this association regime, I would argue you should really reread those. That is a little chapter, and reread that and think about, is this really what the EU should, how the EU should regulate these islands, as it is mostly today, by using the language of inhabitants and not peoples and so on. So I think there you could just like concretely redraft, I think. And then in terms of, I think that is a question that I, in a way, would like to think much more about. So, how do we use these legal categories that may have had, that were drafted in the context of colonial legal politics, and in some way were shaped by them? How do we use them today in a different way? How do we make sure that they're not used to harbor, let's say, the same type of discrimination and so on? Perhaps mostly that is a question that is interesting in relation to, as you said, non-discrimination and workers. And I would say there again, a little bit, as I said before, I think there are cases from the Court of Justice that accepts, like I always take the example of the case Jyske Finans, which is a case from the Court of Justice of the European Union in 2017, where two EU citizens would like a car loan, and one of them is born outside of the EU and the other one is not. And the one that is born outside of the EU has to show additional documentation of their identity, and the one who's born inside the EU does not. And the Court of Justice said, that's fine. That is not discrimination based on ethnicity. And such a case to me, would be an example of a case that again accepts this distinction between ethnicity of two EU citizens, the way that those distinctions were accepted in 57. And so I would kind of use, let's say, the knowledge from how colonialism shaped the EU as an imminent critique, if we want to talk a bit in sort of academic language, but as a critique of what colonialism did to EU law. Very often we think about what did colonialism do to the countries and territories that were colonized, and of course that is very important. But what I'm interested in is what did we do to, let's say, ourselves, and I think that these ways of accepting discrimination, these ways of accepting that we don't actually do equal treatment the way we might think we do, these are self-inflicted wounds that in some way we need to heal, and that I think we can heal as well. But to me, that is the important part, that this is a way of criticizing what this history, this colonial history, has done to the laws of the European Union itself internally.
This is interesting to see how these topics are absent from the current discussions on the EU reform, treaty reform. It mainly regards the competencies of the EU or the member states, but not the inherent problems with the concepts, like the basic concepts of the EU treaties. And so on this note, we will end. And thank you very much, Hannah, for your time and insights and sharing them with us.
Thank you very much. It was very nice to talk to you.
Thank you, and up until the next time.